Our scripture passage this morning is from Exodus 16. I'll read just the first five verses, but as we continue in our study of Exodus, we're going to look at the whole chapter of chapter 16 because it is an important one. But the first five verses is what I'll read to you now. God's word says this, Exodus chapter 16, beginning in verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, you are to prepare what they bring in, and that it is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." This is the very word of God. Would you pray with me? Father in heaven, this story of manna in the desert is one that may be familiar to all of us. But I pray that you would open our hearts and our minds this morning to bring a fresh message, one that not only informs us, but serves to transform us. And I ask these things in the power of your Spirit and in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. You may be seated. Many of you who are paying close attention know that we left off in chapter 14, and now we're in chapter 16. What happened here? Well, chapter 15 is essentially a song of praise for moving through the Red Sea, for God's gracious provision, for his heroic work, and for the destruction of the enemy. And this rejoicing really simply recounts God's greatness, his power, and his authority over all things. At the very end of chapter 15, we now see Israel on their way again. After they have passed through the waters of the Red Sea, they are now faced again with yet another challenge. And that challenge is coming to what looked like a fresh supply of water at Marah. Yet when they tasted the water was bitter. And then God asked Moses to do something really crazy. He said, "Take a hunk of wood, throw it in the water, everything is going to change." And now we're back to this place with Moses listening to the instructions of the Lord saying, "Are you serious? A hunk of wood into the water, everything changes." Yes. So he does. The water turns sweet. Everybody drinks. And they move on from there. And they find themselves at a town or a village or an area called Elim. And Elim was pretty much paradise. Palm trees, springs flowing. And there was this temptation to just hang out there forever because it was paradise. God said, "Nope, up on your way. This is not about your comfort. This is about me forming you into the people that I want you to be. And most importantly, it is all for my glory." So we have Marah, we have Elim, and now we have them traveling and traversing the desert, and they are at this place where they're no longer content with doing what God had asked. They don't like the desert. It's hot, it's dry, they're thirsty, they're hungry. So they begin complaining. But the reality, as we look at the contour of Exodus up until this point, we see these ups and downs all the way through. God is gracious and provides. Then it seems as though God takes them through the worst of the worst, these tremendous tests and trials. And then back again, God blesses them. And then another trial. This is the contour of Israel's life. And can I tell you, this is the contour of a Christian's life. We all want to hang out in the area of Elim with all the palm trees and all the springs and all the comfort and all the delight, because somehow we have it in our minds that if the Lord is truly good as we know him to be, then he's going to bless us because we have pledged our allegiance to him. And yet it seems every time that Israel confesses their faith and trusts in the Lord, hard times come, not paradise. And again, that contour of their lives is the same pattern that is in the Christian life. In our passage today, what we find is grumbling, complaining, irritation, discontent. Call it what you will, but Israel was voicing their displeasure over God's plan for their lives. As a matter of fact, grumbling is Israel's persistent sin. If there is one, this is the one that they are very consistent at. Moses went to rescue them from slavery in Egypt, and Pharaoh made life harder. What did Israel do? Grumbled. God rescues them from Egypt, takes them out on a journey, and backs them up to the Red Sea. What did they do? Grumbled. You brought us here to die. God miraculously brings them through the Red Sea, gives them this wonderful oasis, and even turns bitter water to sweet water. And yet when they're on their way again, they start to grumble. This was Israel's deal time and time again. Now, we are all familiar with grumbling. We all know complaining at one level or another, whether we are given it or receiving it, right? All of us are familiar with it. Now, most of us have enough pride to say, I don't grumble near as much as I listen to people grumble. I'll give you that, maybe. I don't know. The fact that we are familiar with grumbling says a lot about us. But look at the way God responds to our grumbling. It's nothing short of amazing and remarkable in my mind. You think about the way you respond. If a friend or a coworker is complaining to you, I mean, you might have some level of patience. You might stick with them for a little bit, but usually when it gets too much to bear, you do one of two things. The first thing is you do whatever it takes to make them be quiet, leave the area, ignore them, whatever. Or the old saying, if you can't beat them, join them. Yeah, then you just, it seems to happen strangely and mysteriously, doesn't it? Before you know it, you're complaining along with them. That's the way we often deal with complaint. Actually, there's another one that we often do. If it's someone who's younger than us, say a child, we have this famous phrase, my mom loved it, be quiet or I'll, what? Give you something to complain about. This is our great line. But all of us are familiar with complaining, and all of us have a way with dealing with complaining. God is polar opposite to what we typically do. He has a desire and a design for his people that causes him to respond to grumbling and to complaining in the strangest of ways to us. He is gracious. He is patient. He is compassionate, and he seems to deliver exactly what the people are complaining for. Now, what this tells us is that his desire is to see us proclaim his glory and to see us grow in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, to see us mature in our faith. This is all part of his desire. But he also has a design for that, a particular plan, which is why there are contours in our lives. If things were pleasurable all the time, we wouldn't grumble, would we? But we also wouldn't grow. We wouldn't have anything to challenge us. And in the end, I take it back, we probably would grumble because we're so bored with being so happy all the time. We'd find something to grumble about. It's part of our nature. So God has this desire for us to grow and mature and to praise his glory, but also he has a specific way in which he goes about it, and it's one of the ways that we tend to grumble about. So it's interesting. We kind of go full circle all the time. His plan is to love us with an unconditional love and then to test us every step of the way, because each time we're tested, we're drawn nearer to him. Our faith is increased, and we are more confident, strong, and faithful along the way. So let's take a little closer look at what God is doing here in Exodus chapter 16. Take just a few moments to just look at some of the facts here. If you look at the first three verses, you've already see that what I just read. They're grumbling. They've left the paradise and they're now at a place in the middle of the desert, and they grumbled. The whole community grumbled, verse 2 said. And then they have this great complaint in verse 3. If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. What a silly wish. But grumbling is something that has a strange root. The word grumble at its root means to dwell. You think about that. Why do we complain? We complain because we want to fixate on something until it gets solved, until we feel better. So we dwell on it, and we complain about it, and we grumble about it. You've never grumbled about anything positive. So the grumbling typically comes with something negative. We dwell on something negative. And the reality of grumbling is that there's a whole lot to it. It has a lot of different facets. The first is this. Grumbling is a problem of perception. Grumbling is a problem of perception. If you think about it, Israel had nothing to complain about. They were hot and they were dry and they may have needed some water, but they weren't hungry and they weren't going to die. Because time and time again, we are told that in this enormous crowd of all of these people, there was also something else. What was it? Livestock, animals, birds, fowl, all kinds. Israel was not going hungry because they had all of their food traveling with them. They could have milk, they could have cheese, they could have meat, they could have all kinds of things. They were not doing without. So their perception was off. Now, that is essentially what we do all the time. We confuse our wants with our needs, right? Israel was not going hungry, but they wanted something more. They wanted to be cared for in a way that was not difficult, which caused them to have another problem with perception, and that was saying things were so much better back in Egypt. We sat around pots of meat and everything was amazing. This was awesome. They did not. We read about all of this. How were they treated in Egypt? They were treated as slaves. If they were given more food, it was only so that they could work more. They were not fat and happy in Egypt. But somehow their mind started playing tricks on them because they were dwelling, grumbling on that which was negative. So first, it's a problem of perception. Grumbling is also a problem of humility, right? Because when we complain, we automatically assume the position of center of the universe. And as center of the universe, we have a lot of demands and needs for our present position, right? So when we complain, this idea of humility goes out the window. Because when you complain, you're saying, I want my way now. And I want all of you to change, to accommodate what I want now. That's the essence of complaining. Israel directs their complaint at Moses. Who are they really complaining to? God. God. So there's almost always a scapegoat in complaining, right? When someone complains to you, are they complaining about you or about someone else? About someone else, right? And this is what the people did. Moses, Aaron, what are you doing? We have nothing to eat. It was so much better back in Egypt. We used to sit around pots of meat. This is hot. This is dry. This stinks. You let us out here. We're going to die. Why couldn't we have just died in Egypt? Moses eventually says, hey, I'm not the guy. Stop talking to me. Take your complaint to the Lord. It is a problem of humility. Finally, grumbling, the last sense of this problem, I'm sure there's more, but grumbling is a communicable disease. Very much so. It says in verse 2 that the whole community of Israel grumbled. My sense is that it probably started with a handful of people. Who told a handful of people? Who told a handful of people? And then the whole community was grumbling. We're all predisposed because of our sin nature to a level of discontent. And you get enough discontents together, even those people who are perpetually happy start to ask questions. Yeah, maybe it isn't so good. Yeah, maybe they are right. hey, I thought you were happy. I was until I talked to these guys. It really stinks out here. So it is a problem of perception of humility, and it is a communicable disease. But look at the way God responds. In verse 4, the Lord said to Moses, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day, gather enough for that day, and this way I will test them to see whether or not they will follow my instructions. Amazingly, God listens and hears the people's whining and complaining and grumbling. We see it in verse 7 and 8 and 9 and 12. He provides for them. So it's more than just listening to their whining. It is responding to their whining with provision. We, as I said before, are either irritated or we join the grumbler. God does just the opposite. He provides for them. He is patient. He is slow to anger. He is abounding in love. His character comes through in amazing ways in this story. The first thing he does is provide quail. He promised bread, but then he provided quail, meat for the people to eat on that first night after this massive grumbling. So quail come, fly over, they have all of the meat that they can eat. And then the very next day, he rains down. It actually doesn't rain down. It appears after the dew dries in the morning. On the ground are these flaky, white breadcrumb kind of things that are sweet when they're tasted. And it's called manna. And manna, we often interpret to mean bread. Manna in the Hebrew means, what is this? I'm not kidding. So the Israelites came out and said, manna, what is this? So it's funny that the word manna that we equate for bread is actually a question. What in the world has God provided here? So their bellies are full from a night of roasted quail, and they wake up the next morning to these white flakes on the ground. They say, what is this? And God gives them specific instructions through Moses. Moses said, here's the deal. This will provide for all of your hunger. Collect it, but only as much as you need. Don't take any more than that. In fact, here's the ration for each family. And this is the way it's supposed to go. So go out and collect it. Don't hoard it. Don't try to keep it for the next day because it will go bad. And listen, when it comes to the weekend, I want you to honor the Sabbath. So gather twice as much. And the people say, well, hold on. You told us not to gather too much because it'll go bad. It's not going to go bad on the Sabbath. Okay, let me get it straight. Gather only as much as we need on Monday through Saturday. On Saturday, gather twice as much. Don't do anything on Sunday and enjoy. Yep, that's the plan. So from that, what we have now is provision from the Lord. Bread and meat, carbs and protein, vitamins and minerals. God provided everything that they needed. The people grumble and God provides. It's not a great equation. I mean, it's not that it's going to work like that every time, but here's what we see. The people grumble, God provided. And it is an interesting deal here, because as we see God's character emerge, we also see his purpose. He gave specific instructions along with his provision. So what we have now is feeding our spiritual bodies with the food, but feeding our souls with the instructions. Because the instructions weren't because he's mean or because he wanted something to do. It's for his glory and our training. His glory, our training. That's why God did this. Food to provide for our stomachs, and a challenge to provide for our growth in faith. We are saved for his glory, and we are sanctified. That's what this whole thing is. This is Israel learning to be the saved people of God. We are saved for his glory, and now we are being sanctified for his glory. That's what's happening to Israel here. What is God's glory? We always hear God's glory. God's glory is his reputation. God's glory is his honor. God's glory is the sum total of all of his perfections. God's glory is his godness. And it represents his power, his might, his provision, his it's hard to even say without saying his glory, because it is so much who he is. And so when we do something for his glory, we do it because God is God and we are not. That's what it means to be saved for his glory and now sanctified for his glory. And to be sanctified for his glory means we surrender piece by piece these elements of our life where we want to be in control. And God says, no, here are the instructions. And we say, well, I don't feel so good. I don't know if I'm going to be able to go out tomorrow and gather the manna. Can I have a double portion today? God says, no, that's not how it works. You gather enough for today and I will sustain you through tomorrow. And we say, I don't think that's going to work for me, God. I need a different plan. And then all of us, of course, have the special provisions for our lives that God should be attentive to, because we don't have the same kind of problems as other people have, right? Our problems are unique to our lives. And God doesn't understand them. We're not cookie cutter people. We're unique, right? He created me different. So he has to understand that my problems are going to be a little bit different. So I can't just fall in line with his instructions in the Bible like other people do, because I'm special. Stop me if I'm getting a little too close to home. No, don't stop me. Because I do the same thing. This is lesson number one in our sanctification. God's saying, I know all this. I know you. I number the hairs on your head. Don't tell me that your situation is unique. Because when you follow my instructions, when you do what I ask, you will be formed into the person who is faithful and who is righteous and who is pure and is holy. And I will be glorified. It's my plan. It's not yours. Follow my plan, God's saying. One of the last things that he does, which is wonderful, beginning in verse 22, is he talks about the Sabbath. And remember, he gave specific instructions for the manna. Can't collect on Sunday. And yet, people collected on Sunday. You know, don't hoard it. Yet, people hoarded. I mean, there's always something that we will do that throws it off. I mean, the typical things happen. If you look at verse 17 in chapter 16, verse 17 says, the Israelites did as they were told, and we all breathe a sigh of relief. Ah, this is good. Some gathered much, some little, and then they measured it by the omer. The one who gathered much did not have too much. The one who gathered little did not have too little. Oh, it's working exactly the way God said it would work. And then we read verse 20. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So what we have is this reality check, right? God gives a command. Some of us step into the line and we experience his love and this, it is so good to be in step with the Lord. And then there's always some of us who say, I don't want to do what the Lord said. I want to go a different direction. And what happens after this? Well, it says in verse 20 that Moses got angry. Did God withdraw their food? Did God say, you're no longer in the community? Out. See ya. No, none of that. What God did was provide manna the next day. And he provided for those people who didn't want to obey, grace. Enormous grace. He said, listen, you screwed that one up. I forgive you. Tomorrow we're going to do it my way, okay? And I guarantee you there were people the next day who didn't do it his way. He didn't take their food away. He gave them grace. To be saved by the blood of the Lamb, which Israel was, means to be a part of God's covenant community, to be a part of his family. And though there will be times of testing and learning, there's not times of being kicked out of the family. Those in Israel who were saved by the blood of the Lamb during Passover are permanent members of God's family. And it's part of his instruction. Now that you are saved, here's how you are to live. Now that I have rescued you, here's how you are to live. the order of things is important. Which is why, after he tells them the specific instructions for consuming the food, he also says, there's another piece, this Sabbath piece, that I ordained a long, long time ago when I created the heavens and earth. I rested on the seventh day. I want you to do the same. Because when you rest on the Sabbath, you take a much needed break, but also you learn to depend on the one who made you. And we see something very similar. Look at verse 27. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Most of the people obeyed. Some of the people didn't obey. Did God take their food away? No. They didn't know how to interpret the Sabbath, so God says, let me show you grace. And you'll interpret the Sabbath next time because I created it for a reason. So we have this passage here where there are many things to learn. We know that God will provide for those whom he saves. He just will in amazing ways. And the less we grumble, the more we realize this provision on a day-to-day basis. The reverse is true too. The more we grumble, the less we see God's provision. It puts blinders on us. We have a problem with perception and humility, and it's a communicable disease. If we become bitter or sour, it's because God has blessed us and we've hoarded it, just like they did with the manna. Just like Israel, we need to learn to live for the praise of God's glory. And just as Israel failed, we're going to fail too. But here's the best part. Just as Israel received God's grace over and over and over again, we receive God's grace over and over and over as well. We have to understand the order of things, though. God rescued his people first. First, he got them out. First, he saved them through the waters of the Red Sea. Now he's teaching them to live and to be obedient. Get that. Their obedience did not save them, but their obedience will sanctify them. Their obedience meant nothing to getting them out of Egypt and bondage to slavery. The only thing that mattered was the blood of the Lamb sacrificed and the power and might of God. That's what saved them. They did nothing on their own power. But once saved, God says, now, I got a plan. And I hear you're grumbling, and I know you're complaining, but I want to show you what it means to praise me for my glory. You want to grow in your faith? You begin with praising God for his glory. You want to understand more what it means to walk a Christian life? Begin with God's glory. Every single time, it is God's glory. But there's another beginning. And that is, just as Israel was saved by the blood of the Lamb, we are saved by the blood of the Lamb, Jesus Christ. That's where we start. First, we are saved through no work of our own, through no obedience of our own, through no following of rules, but simply by the grace of God. And then we begin a journey with the same contours that Israel had, up and down, pleasure, pain, difficulty, happiness. It's all part of the pattern. And God continually gives us these instructions. Hey, do this. And then you know what? When we follow them, there's great joy in our lives. And when we don't follow them, resist the temptation to say, oh, I'm ruined. Because just like Israel, you're not ruined because God's grace is abundant. And every single time you blow it, every single time, you go out on Sunday and you look for the manna and he said it's not there because it's a day of rest. I knew that. It's okay. You are forgiven. There is grace, grace, grace. Jesus, in John chapter 6, ties this event in Exodus chapter 16 to a life in him. And it goes like this, beginning in verse 32. Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, it is not Moses who has given you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is the bread that comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And his followers said, "Sir, always give us this bread." And Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." God's truth. Will you pray with me?